Good evening. Welcome back. Robert and Clyde are going to pass out some little outlines if you'd like to follow along with that. We're preaching the last lesson on the series of qualifications of elders. Tonight we're looking at the elder and his family. We'll read the passages while they're passing out the sheets. And if you've been here for a long time, you know that I preached this series many times before. I don't know, three or four, not necessarily this sermon outline, but some just like it. In 1 Timothy chapter 3, if you'll follow along your Bibles with me, it says in verse 2, a bishop must then be blameless, the husband of one wife. So there's the part we're looking for as far as family goes. Temperate, sober-minded, of good behavior, hospitable, apt to teach. In verse 4, one who rules his own house well, having his children in submission with all reverence. 4, verse 5, if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? And then in Titus chapter 1 and verse 6, it simply says there, if a man is blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. And so that covers pretty much the 5 points we're going to look at in our study tonight. So I hope that you study that. And as we've said already in the previous series in this lesson, it's good to follow these things because it's good for all families to look at this and say, this is what God expects the family to be. We looked at the elder and his personal qualifications and his relationship to society, and now we're looking at the elder and his family. A couple of things in here are the most controversial in our series, and you'll see them as you go along. I think, in fact, as a result of that, some have altered what God expected of the man. But it's up to you to study the Bible, listen carefully to what I have to say, take your own notes, and go home and study this for yourself and see if you agree with what the Bible teaches, what I'm saying tonight. Well, the first one is husband of one wife. Now, that's literally the phrase that's used, and, you know, how do you argue with that? Of course, it's funny, I was looking at a website from a denomination yesterday. I get to looking at one thing, and I start rabbit chasing, and I found this church, I believe it was in Ohio, and they had a list of elders, and about half of them were women. And the first thing I thought was, well, they don't fit that qualification, at least I hope they don't. But anyway, the word wife there in the Strong's Dictionary is a woman of any age, whether a virgin or married or a widow, to a wife, which would be the context here, and even of a betrothed woman. And so the context will determine which one of those words is used. Here's an interesting thing I see people doing all the time. They find a group of definitions like this and say, well, any of those fit. That's not how that works. It's not multiple choice. It's simply like English dictionary. It's giving you all the different meanings, and the context will tell you which one fits. And so the word wife here is obviously, if she's related to the man, then she's the wife, isn't she? And again, husband, again, the word, the Greek word, could be used just of a male. It can be used of a husband, of a betrothed or future husband, with reference to age, number two, and to distinguish an adult man from a boy. Number three, sometimes it means any male, and used generally of a group of both men and women when we see the word man in the Bible. So, in this particular context, again, it simply and literally means the husband of one wife. So that means a man who marries a woman for the first time, is he the husband of one wife? Of course. And here's where the controversy comes. When a man's wife dies and he remarries, is he the husband of one wife? And I'd say yes, and some say no, and that's where the controversy appears, and some are very adamant about it, but let's just keep in mind how that can be. How can you have two wives and one, well, you don't have two wives. In your history, you might have, not at the same time. But in Romans chapter 7 and verse 4, it talks about, verse 3, so then if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she would be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. We know that marriage is for life. And when the mate dies, you're no longer married to that person. And so a husband whose wife has passed away is no longer the husband of one wife. And so Romans 7, 1 through 4 points that out, as well as Matthew 22 and verse 30, because Jesus said in heaven, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels of God. And so the marriage contract being until death do you part, if a man loses his wife to death and then marries again, he how many wives does he have? He has one. So he's the husband of one wife. But sometimes people have a problem that, well, I don't get that because this man had two wives. Well, not one at a time. It doesn't say one at a time. Well, it does say husband, one wife. If you stop and think about it, how many does the fellow have? Well, again, when a man's wife commits adultery and he scripturally divorces her and marries again, is he the husband of one wife? And the answer is yes. Again, Romans 7, 1 through 4. Jesus in Matthew 19, 9 said that a man can put away his wife for adultery and marry again, and he's not held accountable for that. And so once again, we have the concept of here's a divorced man who is married to one wife, and we just don't know if we want an elder who's been divorced. But again, what does the Bible teach? And that's what we've got to go by, not what our opinion may be or how we feel comfortable. But at the same time, a congregation has to accept somebody they're comfortable with, and even though they may be literally the husband of one wife, maybe there's other circumstances that would cause them to be hesitant to appoint that person. But from a technical standpoint, these are all husbands of one wives. So I believe the marriage contract ends between a husband and wife when the divorce is done for the scriptural cause of putting away, that is fornication, adultery. To remarry would make that brother once again the husband of one wife. And again, if you disagree with that, then you need to get your scriptures and your reasoning and explain why that would not be so. Now, what's interesting here, to show you how dangerous translations can be, Moffat, Goodspeed, Weymouth, William Barclay, and the New American Standard Version specify married only once. But now when I showed you the definition, the literal meaning of that phrase in the Greek is one woman man, husband one wife. That's not the same as saying being married only once. Saying being married only once, first of all, doesn't translate the Greek words, and number two, it's a commentary, not a translation. And so be careful what you listen to on certain occasions. Also, it mentions in 1 Timothy 3, in verse 11, the wife's qualities. It says, likewise, their wives must be reverent, not slanderers, temperate, faithful in all things. Now, I agree that when you look at 1 Timothy chapter 3, the wives seems to be after the qualification of the deacons. And some would say, well, because of the context, the wives only refer to the wives of deacons. But I think logically that doesn't make sense, because why would you have these qualifications for the wife of a deacon, but not any for the wife of an elder? Because it's all important, so I think it applies to both. And so what does it mean to be reverent? Well, the King James Version uses the word grave. Well, the first definition is august, venerable, reverend. Number two, to be venerated for character or honorable, and I think that's what it's talking about here. She must have a character among the brethren that is respected. Number two, not slanderers. King James Version uses the same word. And that's obviously someone who says things that aren't true. They tend to misrepresent people or accuse people falsely. That's what the devil does. And obviously if an elder's wife does that, then she's not going to help him in his job. Temperate, number three, or as the King James Version says, sober. And that simply means sometimes literally abstaining from wine, either entirely or at least from its immoderate use. But the first definition of being sober or temperate is somebody who I would say has a very balanced temperament. They don't get too excited or too low. They're not too emotional. They, under stressful situations, would handle themselves well. And then faithful in all things. Well, the first definition of faithful is faithful or trustworthy. 1A, of persons who show themselves faithful in the transaction of a business or the execution of commands or the discharge of official duties. And then 1B, one who kept his plighted faith worthy of trust in 1C, someone that can be relied upon? Well, I think, again, the context would say someone who's faithful to her husband, faithful to the Lord, faithful in the relationship that will make his job easier because she's not a hindrance to him. So that's interesting to look through that, and we can all ask ourselves, is that the kind of person I am? Wives, whether you're going to be an elder's wife or not, a good godly wife would fit all of these qualifications. That's what we strive to be as a human being and as a Christian. Well, the next qualification is ruling his own house well. And it says in the New King James Version, having his children in submission with all reverence. And notice in the parentheses, which obviously is put in there by the translators, if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? I think that is very key when we're trying to figure out what this means. Well, we look at the definition. Rule simply means to be over, to superintend, to preside over. So a husband is to be the head of the family. And men and husbands in the audience, keep in mind that you're the spiritual leader of your family. It's your job to set the spiritual tone. So many times we don't see that in the church, and we certainly don't see it out in the world. Maybe the wife and children will go to church, and the husband stays home and watches TV and gets ready for the football game and keeps his bathrobe and slippers on until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And so he said, well, I sent the wife and kids on to church like it's some kind of childish activity. Others say, well, I'll go to church, but they don't lead their family at home. They don't put it as a priority. So men, if you ever want to be an elder someday or a Christian that God will be proud of, realize the tone begins with you. You're the head. You're the beginning. You're the leader. You need to take that role. Number two, his own household. Well, I like the definition Strong gives here, the inmates of a house. Sound like prison, doesn't it? I don't know how you can say inmates of a house. I've known some houses that I guess they felt like prisoners in their own house. But it's simply all the persons forming one family, a household. So that's not hard to understand, is it? One who rules his own house well. And then the word well, beautifully, finely, excellently, and 1A, rightly, so that there shall be no room for blame, truly. And so when you're looking for an elder, you're looking for a family that is like this. The husband is the head of the family. He's the spiritual leader. He emphasizes the importance of spiritual things, and his house is well controlled. And let me say something about that. The worst way to control your family is to try to be a dictator. Because think about the reason why these qualifications are here. First of all, because you're showing that your ability to rule well over your family. And then you take that quality and you apply it to the church. Well, now, if this had the idea of, well, I'm going to rule with an iron fist and I'm going to tell my wife and kids, you do what I say or else, blah, blah. Well, now, take that attitude to the church and how well is that going to translate? You think an elder's going to get up here and say, all right, I told all you people to be here at such and such a time, and you better snap to it or else something's going to go wrong. I've seen guys who act that way, but that's not how you rule a house well in your family, and that's not how you rule a house well in the Lord's church. And so that dictatorial attitude is absolutely the wrong one. The idea is that you, in love, put your wife on a pedestal, make her a better person than she would ever have been had she not married you. You teach your children to do what is right in the Lord and show them why it's right. And then expect them to do what's right, and then there's the fair and proper discipline when they disobey. And children who are loved by their parents and by their father respond better than those who feel like they're just being forced to do things against their will. And so that's something interesting about that. Again, it says, having his children in submission with all reverence. Well, the word having simply means what? To hold oneself or find oneself in such a state. So somebody who has children, obviously. Children is offspring, children, 1A. Notice this, the word children, though it's in the plural in the Greek, can be sometimes a child, one. 1A1, a male child, sometimes a son. So it's interesting, the word children can include one or more. And there's where some of the controversy arises. Sometimes churches say, well, he doesn't have children, he only has a child. And again, the context will tell you that any in his household or what it referred to. We're not talking about how many children a man can have. He can have 10 children or he can have one. It doesn't. That's not what the qualification is all about. The qualification is about rulership. And so if I were to ask the question, everybody who has children, raise your hand. If you had one child, what would you do? You'd raise your hand. And so we don't have a problem with that here that I know of, but simply emphasizing Strong's Greek English Concordance points this out, that the general definition is offspring or children, but it can include a child, and sometimes it has reference to a male child. Well, questions then, and we've already asked one of them, is a man with one child a person who has children? Well, if you go by the definition of the word, you'd have to say yes. And then having his children in submission with all reverence. What does submission mean? It's one of those dirty words in American terminology. But in the Bible, it's a very biblical word because all of us have to be subject to somebody. All Christians are subject to God. All faithful Christians are subject to the government for conscience sake. All young people in the church are subject to the older people out of respect. And the Bible even says, submit to one another. So we're all in submission to one another at one point in time. And so when a father has his children in submission, again, the word simply means the act of subjecting, obedience, subjection. The real key is, how do you do that? How do you get your children to obey in a proper way? And then with all reverence, the characteristic of a thing or person which entitles to reverence and respect, dignity, majesty, sanctity. It can also mean honor and purity. So again, a child is supposed to be obedient to the father, but when they do it reverently, it's because the father has shown his ability to rule without being domineering over that family. And I think that's a very strong quality and one that we should really emphasize today. Some men fail in this responsibility because they're never home to raise their children. They're gone at work, and then they're gone at play, and they're never home to take care of their family. Well, it's impossible to bring a child up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord if you're not there, isn't it? And others have neglected their children by leaving their upbringing to the wife. And so his family is to be an example for others to imitate. And obviously, this is a matter of judgment left to the congregation as to how well a man is having his family in submission with all reverence. But that's what the Bible teaches. And so, I don't think that's difficult. I think the church in general would look at a family and say, well, they're doing pretty good. You don't have a perfect husband. You don't have a perfect wife. And you certainly don't have perfect children. Sometimes you do have children who operate on cue, but... I know Emily and I, when we were raising our kids, every once in a while, they were small children, under 10 years of age, and every once in a while, we'd have a whole week go by, and I'm like, man, they were just perfect. Rebecca was great, didn't fight with her brothers too much, and Kevin and Randy were doing pretty good, and Emily and I would look at each other and say, you know, I think we finally got this thing whipped. And then the next day showed up, and it all came unglued. Like, oh, don't ever say that again, because that happened more than once. I think we got the, oh, don't say it, we remember what happened last time. It just shows that children are human beings and that we're all imperfect and that perfect obedience is a difficult thing to obtain. And so you look at it in a general characteristic sort of way. You certainly know when you have unfaithful or rebellious children, don't you? Well, now Titus chapter 1 and verse 6 goes to a different statement. And in Titus 1 and verse 6 it says, having faithful children not accused of dissipation or insubordination. And again, this is probably the most questioned qualification because people say faithful children means believing children, baptized believers. The other side of the coin is faithful to the Father, just like we see in 1 Timothy 3. Because if you notice in 1 Timothy 3 again, it doesn't say anything about a baptized believer. In fact, in the New King James and King James Version, it doesn't say that either. It says faithful children. Faithful children doesn't mean baptized believer. But we've translated it that way, and most brethren I know of say that's what it means. But let's look a little farther on that subject. The word faithful is a very common Greek word in the New Testament, and the first definition is trusty or faithful. Well, that's what we mean. If a man is faithful to his wife, we know what that means, don't we? That means he's loyal to her and he doesn't have a girlfriend. And he comes home every night, unless he tells his wife where he's going. We know what faithful means. You know what it means if you're faithful at work. That means you show up, you're there, you do your job, and so on. And that's the same meaning in the New Testament. But then notice as it goes and defines further 1A of persons who show themselves faithful in the transaction of business, the execution of commands, or the discharge of official duties. That same word was used of elders and deacons' wives, remember? 1B, one who has kept his plighted faith worthy of trust. 1C, somebody who can be relied on. So we sometimes say, well, that guy's not trustworthy. And we mean by that faithful. You can rely on him or you can't. Number two, someone who's easily persuaded. That's a secondary definition, but according to Strong's, that's used in the New Testament. And then 2A, believing, confiding, or trusting. So it's possible to translate the word pista as believing children. The King James didn't do it. The New King James didn't. And we'll talk about that in a moment. So why didn't they? 2B in the New Testament of one who trusts in God's promises. 2B, one who's convinced that Jesus had been raised from the dead. That's a specific belief. 2B, two, one who has become convinced that Jesus is the Messiah and author of salvation. So those are all the choices you have. But again, it's not multiple choice. Say, well, I get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I picked this one. This is what I believe. That's not how that works. We have really two choices here. One who's faithful in the transaction of the business, the execution of command. And that would be someone who's faithful to the Father. Now, if you mean to be one who's convinced that Jesus has been raised from the dead, then you could translate that a believing child, one who, and then you have to go one step further and say that's a baptized believer, which is not even the context. But again, the question, which is it? Well, let's look at it this way. Paul does not use the word Christian, but faithful. And in the Greek, the word pistis, the general word, is used 67 times. 57 times it's translated faithful. 6 times it's translated believe. 2 times it's translated believing. And 1 time it's translated faithfully. And another time it is not translated at all into the English translation. It's just left out. But the King James Version, New King James Version translators believed faithful was the correct rendition. And thus I would argue that they're agreeing with what my position is, that the child is to be faithful to the Father, and he has proven his ability to rule his children well. Now, a lot of brethren would say, well, that's just not right. Well, let's look on. Don't give up yet. Where did the idea of believing children come from? Well, the American Standard Version translates it as believing children. The New American Standard also translates it this way. And the lesser translations of Moffat, RSV, Goodspeed, Weymouth, New American Bible, Barclay, and NIV, but none of those I would recommend as a translation, but they also translate it believing children. So it must be understood that you have to ask yourself, now how are you going to figure out which is right? Because you can't say, well, I think this and I think that. What we'd like to do is try to figure out which it really is, not on what everybody thinks. I preached this lesson before, and a fellow came up one time and said, well, I've never heard that before. Well, what did you hear? Well, I've always heard it's believing children. Well, great. Where do you get that idea? Titus chapter 1. I said, well, read it to me. And he didn't have the American Standard Version, so he got lost. It shows us how much we depend on what we've heard or what we've learned, what we've grown up hearing. And so you give some different reason, and people have a hard time changing because they're not reasoning it out. But let me give you my reasons for why I think it's faithful to the Father. Now, that doesn't mean we don't all want our children to obey the gospel. It doesn't mean we don't want our children to grow up and be believers. But there's several reasons why I don't think it's believing children in this passage. Because how you determine the meaning of the word pista or pistis is the context. Which of those definitions best fits the context? Not which one do you think is right, you've always heard is right, but which one fits the context? Well, the passage in Timothy suggest a man should have children in submission with all reverence, which is identical to faithful children. As we're studying the letters to preachers in 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus in our Bible class, you remember I asked this question. I said, are the qualifications given to Paul, by Paul to Timothy, and are the qualifications for an elder given by Paul to Titus, are they identical or parallel or similar? And everybody said yes. Do you combine the two to get one set of qualifications? And when you come to this passage here, you have to say yes in order to get believing children. Because if you use these as a commentary one upon the other, just like we do in Ephesians 5, 18 and 19 and Colossians 3, 16, they're not identical, but they are similar. Ephesians 5, 18 says, be filled with the Spirit, speaking to yourselves in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing, making melody in your heart to the Lord. But what does Colossians 3:16 say? It says, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly, teaching and admonishing one another in psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, singing, making melody in your heart, singing with grace in your heart to the Lord. So we compare the two and we say, well, obviously, when the Bible commands a Christian to be filled with the Spirit, he does so by letting the word of Christ dwell in you richly. Amen. So you see how they're not parallel, but they are very similar, and one is a commentary upon the other. It's a divine commentary. Well, unless you're going to say Paul gave Timothy an incomplete set and Paul gave Titus an incomplete set, then I think logic and reason would say Timothy has all he needs to appoint elders. Titus has all he needs to appoint elders. Therefore, you do not combine them, you compare them. And you're going to come up generally with the same kind of person. And again, if you take that position, then you've got to admit that faithful children does not mean believing children in Titus chapter 1. My second argument would be no place in the New Testament are parents responsible for their children obeying the gospel. Fathers bring them up how? In the nurture and admonition of the Lord. Does it say fathers be sure they're baptized? No. Why is that not true? Because that's not the father's responsibility. Fathers are to teach their children the truth, bring them up in the way of the Lord. When they become adults, they make their own decision. Can you imagine as an adult me saying, well, I became a Christian because my dad told me to? That's his heart's desire. But training a child and then saying it's your fault if he doesn't obey are two different things altogether. And so we don't have to go very far to remember Ezekiel chapter 18, where in verse 20 it says, the soul who sins shall die. The son shall not bear the guilt of the father, nor shall the father bear the guilt of the son. The righteousness of the righteous shall be upon himself, and the wickedness of the wicked shall be upon himself. And on it goes, talking about individual responsibility. So when my children face God in the judgment day, they're going to give an answer for themselves. God's not going to say, did your dad make you obey the gospel? And you know what's interesting? I've preached this in a number of places, and I've never seen the objection to this answered. I was in Oklahoma City, and I pointed this out. I said, the father is never responsible for the child obeying the gospel. And yet, if you make believing children the meaning of Titus 1 and verse 6, now you're placing the responsibility or the guilt of that child's obedience upon the father. And a very well-noted gospel preacher got up because we were having a discussion. He got up and says, well, I don't think it means that. And my answer was, well, then what does it mean? We're talking about the qualifications of a man. And if you make it believing children, if his children don't obey the gospel, then he's not qualified. You see, it does put blame on him. And I have a real objection to that because that's not the father's responsibility. And so that's my second argument. And then the reason given for this qualification is, if you compare with 1 Timothy 3, if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? Now think about that. Do we expect elders to go out and convert people? No, we expect elders to oversee the flock of already converted people, believers. And so, if a father can rule his own house well, those under his charge at home, and have faithful children in Titus 1, or have children in submission with all reverence, 1 Timothy 3, And the reason for that is because that shows he knows how to rule a house well, and therefore he'll be a good ruler of the Lord's people. Baptized believers has nothing to do with it, does it? And so I hope you can see the difference. And then it goes on to say in Titus 1, not accused of dissipation or insubordination. And again, that's interesting because the word dissipation, or the King James Version riot, says an abandoned, dissolute life, profligacy, prodigality. In other words, the prodigal son type personality, one who's not submissive to God's will, someone who is not under the Father's control. Insubordination. King James Version used the word unruly. One not made subject to, unsubjected. Two, one that cannot be subjected to control, disobedient, unruly, refractory. Now, when you have a child like that in the Old Testament, what were they supposed to do with him? Take him out and stone him. I don't know that there was many cases of that in Israel because you couldn't get the adults to obey God, much less expect their children to. But that's exactly what the Word is teaching. Now, again, we have the context, again, of Titus chapter 1. It says, having faithful children, not accused of dissipation and insubordination. So you see, faithful, based on the context, would be somebody who rules his own house well and his children are obedient to the Father. Because if it was believing children, it'd say faithful in attendance and something of it like that. But it doesn't say that. And so I think brethren have made the improper assumption that faithful children means believing children, even though the context doesn't dictate that. Yes, that's one of the definitions, but it's even the inferior of the definitions. Usually the word means faithful, reliable, trustworthy. And if we wanted to go by numbers, I'd say, well, it's translated faithful more times than believing, therefore faithful wins. Except we don't do it that way, do we? My father debated a Baptist preacher one time, and they were talking about the necessity of baptism, and the Baptist preacher made this argument. He said, the word faith appears 56 times in the Bible, and baptism only appears 53. And his argument was, therefore, you have to be believed, you don't have to be baptized. That doesn't make sense, does it? And my father got up and answered, as you should. He said, Mr. West, he said, how many times does God have to command you to do something before you should do it? It's obvious that that doesn't hold water. Well, neither does faithful or believing. So you have to go back and again, look at the arguments I've made. 1 Timothy 3 and Titus 1 are parallels to be compared one with the other. The context in 1 Timothy 3 talks about the father's ability to rule his own house well. Titus 1, faithful children. How should that be translated? Children who are not accused of ruling or dissipation, unruliness or dissipation. It tells you right there in the context what it is. And yet in spite of that, brethren have pulled an obscure translation out and said, oh, that means believing children, and if they're not baptized, then they can't be an elder. Well, if that's what the Bible taught, I'd agree with it. But in all my heart, every time I study this and preach, it's like I'm more convinced all the time that that's not correct. Now, here's what's interesting, too. Some brethren I know, and I've got good friends who believe it's believing children, nothing I've said would change their mind. They wouldn't debate it, though, because I think they'd lose. But they say, well, now, if you have two children that are of age of accountability, they've obeyed the gospel, and you have one, let's say, that's 8 years old, then that 8-year-old isn't included. Where'd you get that? That mean if the word meant faithful, not accused of dissipation or unruliness, could you have two good children, one rebel, and that'd be okay? Well, he's just an 8-year-old rebel. Well, wait till he gets older. It's going to get worse. And yet, I can understand how faithful, obedient to the Father, because he's able to rule his house well, fits the context very well, and it also makes perfect sense. So that's my lesson. You can study it on your own. I encourage you to do that. If you think I've missed the boat, then let me know. And if you want your own free time to answer that, you're welcome to it. As I warned, this is the most controversial of the three lessons we preached. But always study the Bible for yourself. Come to reasonable scriptural conclusions, not ones you think are right. And base your choice for elders now or in the future based upon God's word, not man's opinion, and certainly not brethren's past beliefs. And young men and women, may God bless you to become what God wants you to be. And may someday you marry a mate that will help you get to heaven, and that your family will be a blessing to the society you live in, to our country, and especially to the church. We need more preaching on families, what husbands should be, what fathers should be, what wives should be, what mothers should be, what children should be. Because as we used to say in America, the hand that rules the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. I'm glad you helped me out. I wouldn't have made it if you hadn't said that. That's true. It's still true today. And so we say, what's wrong with America? Well, the family. Part of it is because evil people have realized that. They've done everything they can to destroy the family as God would have it. And so in doing that, they're trying to destroy America. But that's a whole other subject. But here we have what I believe these characteristics are. The husband of one wife, a man who's scripturally married. One who rules his own house well, he shows the ability to lead through his family. Having his children submission with all reverence, obedient, reverent children. And that word reverent might be better translated respectful. Children who are respectful of others. For if a man does not know how to rule his own house, how will he take care of the church of God? So here's a man who's demonstrating leadership at home, and then therefore he can show leadership in the church. Having faithful children, not accused of dissipation or insubordination, Timothy or Titus says, respectable children who do not live recklessly, disobediently, or in a way that brings shame and reproach upon the church or upon that family. And one side lesson, young people, if you're listening, is sometimes young people have the idea, what I do is nobody's business but mine. That could never be true. Everything you say, everything you do, everywhere you go, and everything you are is a direct reflection upon your parents. It's always been that way, and it will always be that way. And so make your parents proud of you by being a good person wherever you go and whatever you do. Hiding your guilty actions doesn't help you, doesn't help society, doesn't make you a better character, and it harms your parents. And children, if you don't believe that your children's actions can be devastating to the parent, wait until you become one. And you'll see that that exactly is the case. There's no greater sorrow than children who fall away from the Lord and who go out and serve the world and Satan. And so keep that in mind, and that's a free extra lesson. I won't charge you for that, but it certainly is true. So if you haven't obeyed the gospel tonight, we're going to sing Who Will Follow Jesus. If you'll follow Jesus in faith, repentance, confession, and obedience, I can promise you one thing. Living the Christian life may not be as popular today as it was when I was a teenager. But living the Christian life will always be the best life you can live. Amen. And when your life is over, if you lived a Christian life to the best of your ability, you'll not regret it. I've been at the bedside of people who were dying, and they wished they'd obeyed the gospel. I've never been at the bedside of a Christian who served the Lord to the best of their ability and said, well, I wish I'd done less. Every time it's been, I wish I'd served the Lord more. I wish I'd studied my Bible more. I wish I'd helped others more. I wish I'd told others about Jesus Christ more. But they never say, oh, I sure am sorry I became a Christian. When you're laying on your deathbed, if you're lucky enough to have one, that's the one thing and the only thing that's going to mean anything to you. Because when you die, you step across the valley of the shadow of death, you're going to meet Jesus Christ face to face. Will he be your Savior or will he be your judge? What you choose in this life answers that question. So I hope you obey the gospel tonight while we stand and while we sing.